All right, everybody. Hello and welcome back to another episode of In Liberty and Health. We're at episode 321. 321. Hopefully everybody's having a fantastic week, fantastic evening. Hopefully my audio quality is better. Thank you. I think it was Sam Whiplinger who put in my mind that my audio quality sounded like crap. And then Jacob said, yeah, I heard a little bit of static. My guest today, anyways. Last time he was listening to me or something like that. So regardless, new equipment's on the way. I promise I'll sound beautiful and better. And I have like this nice little soundboard where I could put like round of applause and stuff like that. But anyways, I won't keep you guys too much longer in this section of the show. Make sure you hit all the links below where you can find my guest, what he's got going on, as well as myself, tigerfitness.com for all your supplements and all that good stuff. Fox & Sons Coffee for the coffee that supports you and the coffee that I drink a whole crap ton of. I think I still have a bag up here, actually. There you go. Our Brazil Honey Prep. It's just called Brazil now, but this is good stuff. Make sure you have a coffee grinder so you can enjoy that stuff. And without further ado, guys, let's rock and roll. And it has been 219 episodes, I think. I was looking it up earlier today. You were on last, or well, I think your first and only time on episode 102. But anyways, Jacob Winograd from the Biblical Anarchy Podcast. How you doing, man?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back on. Yeah, it's been a little while, but we've both been pretty busy.
Well, you were on my other show, Cognitive Vigilance, which I enjoyed quite a bit. And you've been making a little bit of a name for yourself between, all the debates and stuff like that. So what's kind of been new for you lately, other than Libertarian Party stuff, which we will touch on just a little bit?
Yeah. No, I've been, yeah, I guess I recently did that debate with Andrew Wilson on the Crucible, which was, man, that, I mean, I've watched his debates before, and so I was expecting the debate style, but what I wasn't really counting for was just how mentally exhausting it is to go at it for 3 hours. Like, by the time we got to like the third hour, I felt drunk. Like I was like slurring my words, trying to like put two like more than one sentence together. It's just like my brain was totally fried. But yeah, I mean, I've been trying to. I think I don't know exactly when or how it started. It felt sort of organic, because like last year I went on a Christian nationalist stick, but that was intentional and planned because the Libertarian Christian Institute, which is the organization that my podcast is through, they're the authors of that book right there, Faith Seeking Freedom. So we went to Freedom Fest last year and we did like a whole thing on nationalism and Christian nationalism, like a main stage event and then a breakout session on it. And then it kind of died down for a while. And then somehow over the last few months, sort of organically, I started talking about it again. And then suddenly I found myself engaging in the Christian nationalist sphere, which is not a monolith. Like I've been engaging with guys like CJ Engel, who's kind of more of like a post-libertarian Christian nationalist. I've engaged with Stephen Wolf, who wrote the book The Case for Christian Nationalism, and he's more of like a Presbyterian Protestant Christian nationalist, making a strict theological case. And then recently Andrew Wilson, who's kind of like a he's a Eastern Orthodox sort of like right-wing paleocon populist nationalist. So that's been my thing lately. It's just engaging with these people and trying to do it in good faith because I think a lot of them have like valid concerns that they're reacting to. Very similar to when I had you on my show recently and we talked about how a lot of reactionary movements have a kernel of truth to them. So I'm trying to engage with the kernel of truth that they have and recognize it, but then, provide that contrast and alternative solutions to the problems that I can identify with them.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very, very necessary debate, and I'm kind of glad we're starting off here because this is something that I find myself interested in as well. So, a few guests that I've had on over the last couple of months, I definitely talk religion with quite a bit of people, and it's been a very, very interesting conversation because as you start to kind of dive into the roots of morality and where we get our morality from, and maybe even talking about like prescriptions for life, which I generally try not to give, but When it comes to like a societal structure, I think that when you just have libertarianism alone, I don't think that's sufficient. I think it's what you could say is probably necessary, but I don't think libertarianism alone is a solution and end all be all. And I see some people where they get a little bit goofy, and I think this is where you and I kind of run along right beside each other's. When I see people say, "Oh, well, libertarianism is do what thou wilt," which is Satanism, I'm like, okay, well, this is now a little ridiculous. Whereas, like, you know, I think most people would recognize that, like, okay, well, the non-aggression principle would generally lead you in the right direction most of the time, but it doesn't necessarily give you like an ought, like a, once again, a societal structure. It just kind of tells you you generally leave people alone and, you know, basically don't hurt, don't steal, and don't, you know, force sexually copulate anybody.
Yeah, like libertarianism is almost, and so my views have evolved on this, because I think I used to describe it as like the baseline for a good society, but I'm not even sure that's even quite accurate. It's a little bit nuanced, because it's sort of like cause and effect, and I don't know that you're going to have a society that values private property rights to the maximal extent that's going to have a low time preference that's necessary to understand the problems with the state, the problems with central planning and whatnot, which is what libertarianism is, you know, sort of focused on, is the problems of central planning, the primacy of private property rights and whatnot. It's like you won't get there unless you have a culture that sort of lends itself to that. And if you have a very degenerate culture, not only does that kind of fuel the current paradigm we have, which is sort of my critique to the Christian nationalists, is that I think that fighting over the ring of power is not as effective as they think it is, because I don't think the incentive structures are built such as what they think they are. So it's not going to, it's going to backfire on them. But in terms of sort of like sussing out the relationship between virtue and libertarianism, this is what I've been saying a lot lately, like libertarianism needs virtue. And this drives a lot of libertarians nuts, right? Because they're like, well, and what's funny is that half the debate I did with Andrew Wilson was almost like he was arguing against me, like I'm one of these wacky libertarians. I just had to keep like, no, like that's not, because he was like, well, he's like, you're not going to be able to have private property rights unless you enforce them, Jacob. And that means you want to enforce your worldview on others. And I was like, yeah, I do. Like, yeah. I don't have a problem with that. Like, I know there's some libertarians who, you know, are goofy. And like, so I've had this week, they're like, oh, you want to enforce morality on people. I'm like, well, of course. Like, what do you mean? Like, yeah, some things at least need enforced, right? Like, yeah. If like, that's not contrary to libertarianism. But unfortunately, I think a lot of libertarians come to libertarianism, not because they want to create a moral society, but rather because they want something that's going to be a guise, sort of like a bubble of protection for them to live as degenerate and hedonistic as they want. And they don't realize that, I mean, A, that's not really the ethos of true libertarianism. And then two, they don't realize how they are essentially contributing to their own enslavement. And big problem. And so it's like I'm fighting on both ends. I'm trying to fight the left because they're fueling the problem, and then I'm fighting the right because they're not understanding the problem and how to fight it in the correct way. It's like when Andrew's going after degenerates online, love him. Like, I'll support him all day long. I think he's a little bit more aggressive than me, but it is, I mean, one, it's entertaining, and two, it's, you know, like somewhat necessary work to push back on degeneracy in our culture, and to sort of like bring back into the Overton window a lot of these unpopular truths that unfortunately only the red pill people and like the manosphere talk about, but they talk about it in like the worst ways and the worst context, with either zero prescriptions or like really bad prescriptions that just feed into the degeneracy even more. Whereas Andrew actually like takes that, you know, and then puts it within the Christian context to push back. And I love that. Like that part of his mission, I was like, we have a lot of overlap there. But insofar as then he wants to use the state as a solution, that's where things need to get sussed out. But we're definitely on, you know, the common theme of we need virtue for society to function. It's like, yeah, like you need to value people and value morality to even get to the point where you can care about creating a libertarian society.
Yeah, and we're I have like a love-hate relationship with Andrew, and like his wife is one of the best people ever. She's done a lot to promote me. She's done my show twice. I love her. She's great. But I noticed that he kind of wanted to focus in on the gay marriage situation, which you actually kind of influenced my thinking on gay marriage, because I used to kind of be like, oh, well, who cares if the gays want to get married, let them get married. But then over time, I remember, I want to say it was a capitalist communion or wherever it was, where you read,
man, I missed those.
Yeah, well, where you guys talk about it, and then you kind of dug into Will a little bit about gay marriage.
I remember that one.
That changed my mind in that moment. I'm like, oh, you know what, Jacob has a good point, because that's not what you know, the original definition of marriage is, and it's not something that we should necessarily uphold. But where I think you and I agree here, and once again, correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I think Andrew says, oh, well, I want to use the state to like stop that. Okay, but like, what? It doesn't really make sense that we should go knocking down people's doors to make sure that you don't have gay people essentially butt fucking. Like, is this really a worthwhile cause to, you know, pursue and, you know, beat down people's doors? Because eventually that's kind of what you're getting at if you want to say that you want to make sure that gay couples don't get married and stuff like that. Like, I'm all for saying it, like, churches don't recognize gay marriage, but like, once again, if gay people want to have like some kind of civil union or call it a secular marriage, then I don't see the purpose of using the state to stop somebody from doing that, because it seems like such a waste of unnecessary resources. And I'm guessing to Steelman, his argument would be that like, in order to have the prosperous society that you want to see, like a more Christian nationalist society, then it's necessary to uphold virtue, which would be going against gay marriage. But once again, I see that as like kind of a nuance, and you're trying to basically smash a molehill with a nuclear bomb. That's kind of the way that I'm seeing it.
Well, I think Andrew's position is it's a little bit nuanced, because so on one hand, I would agree with part of his position on homosexuality, which is that, and really just on marriage in general. So he actually does think that we should divorce the institution of marriage from the state entirely. Now,
yes,
I agree with him, although we have different reasons for it, because he has this like weird like view of marriage from like I think his Eastern Orthodox perspective, where he's like it's sacramental, and anyway, it's a little bit nitpicky, but I would approach it a little bit differently than him. But in any event, I agree with like the end goal. I think that marriage should just be divorced from the state entirely and just be performed by churches. But then when we got into this in our debate, where he was like, because I was like, okay, in the meantime, should the state be going around and banning and or like using force against gay couples, whether they're calling it marriage or not? And he was basically prescribing that it would be good to, and I was saying that it wasn't, and we had, that was a big point of contention, which went down some really weird rabbit holes, actually, which I wasn't prepared for.
The bestiality.
Yeah, the bestiality, which I was like, in all my time defending libertarianism, I had never had someone go, what about bestiality and necrophilia? I was just like, you know what, I haven't really thought those ones out, so I don't know, I'll have to punt on that. It's kind of weird, and that kind of goes back to actually the first part of this conversation. I was like, man, if we got to use men with guns to stop massive amounts of people from doing this, from doing that kind of you know, messed up crap, we're really suffering as a society. Like,
yeah, I don't think the fucking the goats is your biggest problem at that point.
Yeah, at that point, I'm worried about I mean, God said he wouldn't flood the earth again, but there's a lot of other creative things he could do, so I'm but no, I think so. I think this kind of bump my camera there. I think the issue is that Andrew and a lot of Christian nationalist types like him, they don't understand, like from a philosophical or a theological perspective, the right role of governance. And they also don't understand how to oppose things without using force. It was like, it was almost like he didn't even recognize that there was like another option. It's like, because it was almost like he would keep on accusing me of being pro gay marriage and pro homosexuality just because I didn't want to ban it, which just didn't make sense to me. I was like, if the role of civil governance is just to deal with civil justice, which I establish through like going back to Genesis 9, the passage being that if a man sheds the blood of another man, then by a man shall his blood be shed. So that's kind of like what in Christian philosophy would be called like the establishment of lex talionis, or the principle of just retribution. And that's basically a libertarian right there, right? It's like you're allowed to respond to an initiation of aggression with equal reciprocal force to respond to that aggression, either to stop it or to punish it afterwards. And homosexuality is a sin, but it's just not a sin that commits any act of aggression. And so I think it's important to push back on these things in society and the culture, but I don't think that people like Andrew Wilson and others have given full credence. They haven't learned their libertarian lesson, right? Like, I love what Dave Smith says, like the libertarians need to learn the conservative lesson, but the conservatives need to learn the libertarian lesson. And I just want him to read Getting Libertarianism Right by Hoppe, because like it's just all spelled out right there, and Hoppe says it better than I can. But it's like, you're just not gonna like the incentive structures of these things are just not built the way that Andrew says that they are. And he's like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. And I'm like, sure, in theory, you can describe a perfect state that's just ruled by Christians and they just do everything perfectly. But like, that's not a useful prescription, because it just doesn't bear out. Like, once you give people power, and you know what's funny? There's actually a corollary to like the LP stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because what I view as part of the problem of like with what's going on with like the post takeover LP is that it's like, once you take over any institution of power, you then have to switch from the radicals coming in to try to take it over to change it, to then suddenly now you're dealing with these sort of perverse incentive structures of trying to hold on to the power. And that completely changes the ball game. Now, might be different in a monarchy, right? So, but that's a whole other thing, right? And even Hoppe makes this point that there's in some ways monarchy is almost preferable to democracy, because in a monarchy, it's almost a little bit easier to like, just like, well, this is the ruling family, and unless someone kills them, like, we're going to keep power concentrated through like one line, and they're maybe tied to the church, and they're supposed to uphold a religious tradition and ethos. And, you know, and to some extent that it, like, maybe, right? Like, I mean, in certain instances, we look back through history, you had small, not every monarchy was like, you know, Britain, right? Like, I think sometimes people only think about the worst examples. There are plenty of examples of like, you know, either monarchist or kind of feudalist societies with like lords and stuff, where like it might seem on paper like, oh, that's totalitarianism. But then for the most part, it's like, oh, well, actually, people were pretty much just left alone to do whatever they wanted for large periods of time. And there weren't. So anyway, it's a little bit nuanced there. But I also feel like, OK, like, my prescription is libertarianism, which seems a little bit far off. If your prescription is we're going to go back to Christian monarchism, well, that feels even more like, I don't know, like fan fictiony than me trying to advocate for Ancapistan. Like, we're going to revert back to Christian monarchy. Like, that's just, so anyway, that'd be an interesting conversation to have with him. We didn't get into it, but I guess to connect it back to the gay marriage thing, it's like, like the ultimate thing is to just get it out of the state's hands so that the state stops subverting, the moral institution of marriage. Which I feel like Andrew's position is confused on that, because he's like, well, yeah, get the state out of it, but then still go after gay couples. And I kept asking him, I was like, where's the line? I was like, by what standard are you going to use force and against sin, you know, like, and where does the line as far as like what sins you can use force against and which ones you can't? I was like, are we going to put people in jail for lying? We're going to put people in jail for watching porn. We got people in jail for committing adultery. We're going to put people in jail for, like, I don't know, shorting, like shortchanging someone on a bill or something. I was like, it's like you this can get pretty dystopian pretty quick. And he was like, well, we'd have to comport with reason. I was like, well, that's an easy answer. It just has to be reasonable. It's like, that's just a, that's not even an answer. That's just,
well, who's reason though? That's right. The question that you have to ask is that, because like what may seem reasonable to me, and like, okay, so when we talk about sin in marriage, then like technically I'm married, right? But I'm an agnostic, right? So, does that, and he says this is degenerate. Okay, well, fair enough. But then does that mean you get to beat down my door and throw me in jail because my wife and I are married? I mean, my wife is Lutheran, if I remember correctly. She's not like practicing or anything like that, but she does believe in God and she considers herself of the Lutheran faith or Lutheran denomination. I apologize. So like, okay, well, now is this degenerate and should we stop this? But, you know, much to your point, the idea that we're just going to get the right Christians in to take over the government and enforce our will upon everybody. Okay, well, what's going to happen when there's backlash to that? Because there will be backlash to it. And how are you going to maintain that? And how are you going to set the standard that this person is the correct denomination of your faith, or they're living up to your standards of your faith? Like, I mean, we're talking about incredibly arbitrary lines. And once again, it's very utopian in the way that I'm seeing it. And Kevin said here in the comments, I'll gladly say Christian nationalism is one of the dumbest ideas I've heard in the past year. It's getting some traction online. And I think I had a tweet at one point that said Christian nationalism can't be worse than like the progressive stuff that's going on right now. So I'm not in one camp or the other, Jacob. I think you and I are mostly in agreement. It's funny that I think Andrew's actually, or if that's Andrew, the Crucible Limited. I don't know if that's him or if that's what, but yeah, I it does seem utopian in my mind.
Well, listen, anything can be described in a utopian way. And this was like something that happened in the debate where I was like, yeah, you can describe a perfect Christian nationalism. I can describe a perfect Christian libertopia. But I'm more interested with like what is practical in the real world. I'm more of a political realist. Now, listen, like I've often said, listen, I'll like Christian nationalism can mean a lot of different things. There's a lot of people who could describe my views as Christian nationalism because I have no problem with saying that I want to make society more Christian, right? Like I want to, and I do think that the, like in terms of like who's going to be in positions of governance and positions of influence and what should be like the dominating culture in society, like I want that to be Christian, right? And that's like it. That pisses everybody off, right? That pisses off the leftists. That pisses off the libertarians because they're like, now get out of here. You're trying to, you're just a Christian conservative theocrat trying to come in and subvert libertarianism. And I was just like, well, I'm trying to teach you guys that if you want a society that doesn't rely on the state, you need something that's going to take the place of the state. Because the problem is right now the society has a civic religion and people worship the state as their God. And people are sort of like, we're sort of built to do that. We are built to worship something. And to some extent, like, so the Christian nationalist critique of that, it doesn't, that you can say we don't want blasphemy laws and we don't want, like a certain culture pushed down on people, but that's not really an option. And I think there's some truth to that because I think sometimes the mistake a lot of libertarians make is that they assume that there can be just sort of like this perfect, I guess like quasi-secular neutrality in society. And I just think that's ahistorical. Like it's not even human nature, right? Like, like when libertarians are like, we're not left nor right, and we should just not fight the culture war. I'm like, and I guess this is where I'm just more of a Christian than a libertarian, but like the Bible says we struggle against flesh and blood and against principalities and the forces of darkness, right? So like the culture war is not even the main war. The culture war is sort of like the tip of the iceberg in terms of like what is really going on, which is a battle for the soul of the society that we live in. It's a battle of virtue. And this is why I say, if you want a society that runs along the lines of libertarianism, which means a respect for private property rights, which if you get down to it, that's an expression of self-ownership. So that's an idea of people governing themselves. Okay, well, how can people govern themselves? They can only govern themselves if they are sort of like oriented by some kind of culture, some kind of ethos to do so in their life already, right? Because if they're not oriented towards self-governance, then why would that be a natural outcome? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a natural outcome of a hedonistic lifestyle, of a high time preference mindset where you're pleasure seeking, where you're just kind of living in the moment. Like libertarianism, to actually like think out the arguments, does require just a lower time preference, right? Mm-hmm. I remember like our friend, not Andrew Wilson from the Crucible, but I don't know if you remember Popular Liberty, Andrew, would always say that like the time preference for power. And I think that's actually that observation he made is actually an important observation too, which is that's part of the problem with this as well, is that conservatives and right wingers, we tend to not have good time preferences for power. And so I think that's why it's like, if so, it's both and, right? It's like, if we want, because like if we want a libertarian society, which I think that we should have that, for many reasons, then we need to promote the culture that's most conducive to that. And then on the flip side, for the Christian nationalists, and this was my message to Andrew, and I don't know, it's up to you, Kyle, if you want to invite him on, if he wants to.
No, yeah, I was just trying to let you finish up. I didn't want to be rude and cut you off. Yeah, no, I'm good with inviting him on. I just, like I said, I didn't want to be rude and cut you off.
But I guess just to finish it off, my whole worry is that if we want to have a Christian nation and we want to see Christianity advanced in society, then I think that the more that we give the state power, the more it is that and the more that we normalize having a large centralized power in society, that is going to, as we see, I think it's just empirical, it's used to subvert the church, to subvert Christian values, and to promote a different religion, which is the religion of the state, and the state wants to be sovereign.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was sending over the link to Andrew. Awesome. It's hard to convince people that they're in a spiritual war when they've been led to believe spiritual things don't exist. And you know, I've had conversations with Jay Dyer and Jim Bob about this. And when it comes to the spiritual stuff, and once again, I'm agnostic, so like the way that people view spirituality is very, very different. And like, so my understanding is that like the Eastern Orthodox people believe that like the spiritual world and the world we inhabit is one. And if I'm mistaken, then Andrew, whenever he gets in here, can correct me. And then I'm guessing some people maybe of different denominations believe that, okay, well, like the spiritual life is when you pass away and go to wherever you're going afterwards. And see, there may be some people who, okay, God, yeah.
I actually appreciate the Eastern Orthodox perspective on this. I don't know if you saw when I talked to Matt Erickson a little while ago,
No. But
even though I come from more of a Reformed perspective, and I'm not like I'm like a lower. So you know, there's like uppercase and lowercase L libertarian. So I'm a Reformed Christian, but I'm kind of like there's like uppercase Reformed and lowercase Reformed. More of like a lowercase Reformed. I actually think that's the Eastern Orthodox view of like, no, there's not like a spiritual world and a physical world and that they sometimes touch, but rather these things are sort of like transposed into each other, and that like we live in a world that is both physical and spiritual, which is kind of like, that's sort of what Jesus was, right? Like the incarnation of Christ was that he had, it wasn't that he had like, he wasn't 50% God, 50% man. He was both fully God and fully man. And within the figure of Christ contained simultaneously this human nature and this divine nature. And that that can kind of be hard for people to understand philosophically, but I think that I think that's true for Christ, and I think that that's sort of like a corollary to how society sort of functions as well.
Sure. All right. Well, let's see. Andrew, good afternoon.
What's up, man? Can you hear me?
Yeah. You sound good.
Yeah. I'm just out here doing some yard cleanup. So the stream was sent over to me and it sounded like he had some criticisms of my position. So I figured I'd come on and defend him.
No, that's okay. I don't remember exactly where we were at, but I guess maybe me and Jacob's point. I know Jacob had some stuff that he wanted to get to in the debate that you guys just didn't get to. And
Hang on one second. Let me yell at a kid. Hey, kid, grab me a pack of smokes. All right, do it. All right.
That is the most Andrew Wilson thing to say.
I enjoyed the debate a lot, but I think maybe the one area we could clear up would be if we're supposed to be, let me give you the define it when it comes to gay marriage. What would be the extent that you would want to use the state to stop gay marriage?
I wouldn't allow for there to be any type of sanctification to the marriage at all. So I think that the state has a duty to promote the health and welfare of its citizens, and it should use its power apparatus of brainwashing for the purpose of moving the goalposts towards a more perfect society. So essentially, all the state really needs to do is just not glorify it, and instead glorify intact family units, and we'll win it anyway.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a reasonable position. I would agree with that. I think the only part where I'm confused is that using the state, like, let's say there would be gay people that would want to get married outside of the church, which I think you and both Jacob would recognize.
Yeah. The state wouldn't recognize it. State wouldn't recognize it. Fuck them.
Okay.
They're a small percentage of the population. We're not going to hold the entire population hostage because dudes want to have sodomized sex with each other. We're not doing it.
No, okay. I don't disagree. I don't disagree with Andrew on that. I mean, I think ultimately we agree. We just want
two people can move in with each other tomorrow and they can say and declare that they're married.
Sure.
That's fine. You can do that. No one's saying you can't do that, but there's no reason for society to accept that that's true.
No. And I agree with that position, but I think, and if I have your position wrong, then I apologize, but would it be that you would want to use the state to stop those people from being recognized married? Like if.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're not married. Yes. You're not married. The state would not recognize your marriage. Correct. Just like they wouldn't recognize your marriage to two women. Mm-hmm. How come the state, I don't understand it. How come the state cannot recognize your marriage to two women, but it's impossible for them to not recognize your marriage with a man? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me?
No, that's out of my purview.
Yeah. Yeah. So the thing is that it's very clear that the power apparatus of the state's fine when it comes to recognizing marriage. They don't recognize polygamy right now. In fact, it's illegal and they throw you in jail. What are they doing wrong? They're consenting adults.
Yeah.
I think Andrew's right on that. I mean, I think the church should ultimately be the one that marries people. If people want to say we're married and they want the state and the only reason that government at all of any form should recognize marriages should be to be like, all right, well, you guys, like, because when you get married, you might share property. You're going to have shared custody of the kids and things like that. And so there might be a need for the sphere of law to have a ability to recognize that. But at that point, the only reason to recognize anything would be towards relationships that actually can produce kids and that are actually
the state generative. Right now is persecuting, if you want to use that word, they persecute polygamous marriages and they persecute incestuous marriages even if they can't reproduce. Why is the state allowed to persecute those marriages? Why does society say that that's okay? Because the claim is we don't want to make this a normalization inside of society, even if there isn't necessarily a bad outcome in the union itself. Okay, well, let's just continue to track that logic. Then why can't we persecute other marriage types?
That are
why not?
Illegitimate, right?
That are illegitimate. Why can't we? In fact, I would argue we should.
Okay, so actually, I would agree with your position. In now, Jacob and I think would say that, like, okay, well, our, you know, ideal world would be that you don't have a state involved in any of this stuff at all. But like, I think
why more, why would that be ideal? That's stupid. I want a state involved.
Well, once again, we're talking from our ideal perspective because we believe that, you know, more free societies can. Conducive to better outcomes, but like, okay, so all things being equal,
they're not though. They're not conducive. The more free your society is, the worse the outcomes end up being. They become degenerate because liberty destroys duty. So too much liberty destroys duty. So the problem is that if you're going to have duties inside of society, you're going to have a force mechanism. It's going to be the state. You really don't want to live in a society which is ultimately too free. That would be really bad for you. Worst outcomes ever.
The point that Jacob and I were bringing up earlier, at least that I kind of poised to him, was that I agree that libertarianism by itself is not enough. And I think you would agree with that as well. In fact, you would probably more than agree with that. But I don't think just saying, hey, private property rights, leave people alone, don't take their stuff, is enough to develop a process.
Well, you still
society.
Need government to enforce private property rights,
exactly.
Which is what Andrew pressed me on and I agreed with. There are some libertarians who live in fantasy land and think that private property rights don't require force to back them up.
Well, once again, rights technically don't exist. It is enforce.
It's just it's just a social construct to describe. I mean, really, all that exists is in a descriptive sense is sort of just you know, people can either agree or if they disagree, they'll use force against each other, right? But it does get, and I guess Andrew dropped off. I don't know if he'll come back on, but in the debate. Andrew was pressing me on, should we use force to stop gay people from being together? Which I guess I'd want a little bit of clarification on that, because if the argument is just
why can we use force to stop a brother from having sex with his sister?
Well, I mean, so like the parents should step in and stop that. Absolutely.
No, the state steps in. Are you advocating the state no longer steps in? It is illegal. You can't fuck your sister. The state will arrest you and throw you in jail.
The principle I'm getting at is that if it's my principle that if it's right for me to stop something from happening because it's coercive, it's aggression, it's wrong, then it would also be right for the government to step in and stop that. So as a parent and an adult would have a right to stop incest, to stop things like that, then civil governance could also.
So then I don't understand why you can't just apply that to gays. Like, what's the problem? It's just a natural logical extension. If we can stop brothers from humping their sisters, and we can stop one man from marrying two women, and we can apply state force to that, and you have no problem with it, why is there a problem with stopping homosexual unions with state force? Can you explain that?
Okay. I think my question would be, does it seem like a necessary cause if there are, let's say, a gay couple, you know, that's, let's say they're in a relationship and then they just, you know, live in the woods or whatever in a house by themselves and they're not asking for any glorification, because I don't think we should glorify gay marriage or any marriages between a man and a woman. If it's just a gay couple living by themselves, doing their own thing, and yeah, they may engage in butt sex. I mean, what if they're not really hurting anybody and it's not being glorified? I would agree that it shouldn't be glorified. Uh-huh. Then what is the ultimate harm of just gay people being gay? Because I don't think you're ever going to get rid of homosexuality altogether.
So are you saying then that if a brother and a sister are off at a cabin in the woods humping each other like rabbits, but they're not bothering anybody, the state shouldn't be allowed to do anything about that?
I mean, they shouldn't be doing that. I don't think they should do that, but I mean,
that's not my question.
Sure.
Should the state be allowed to go in and be like, nah, this is incest. It's immoral. It's an abomination. Can't do it. By logical extension of that too. If the only thing is that you're applying here is the harm principle, why can't they have a dead body up there in the middle of the woods and be humping that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that's wrong, but my question is, like, is it worth sending, you know,
it's worth it. So in my world, so here's the contrast between our world, right? Here's your sissy world versus my masculine world. In your sissy world, you can go out to a cabin and fuck dead bodies. And the state can't do anything. And in my masculine world, we say, nah, you can't do that. Even if you're not hurting anybody, fuck you, you're going to jail. Now, well, I think so. honestly, tell me, which society would you rather live in?
I mean,
right. And like I said in our debate, I'm not out there dying on the hills that these laws should be repealed. I think so there's a distinction in sort of libertarian thought between privatization and abolishing. And like, there are some things that libertarians would advocate to abolish. Like, I want to abolish the IRS. I don't think that you would even have much disagreement with that. But do I want to abolish?
Yeah, but they die on the hill of gay sodomy for some reason.
I mean,
I literally don't understand why.
I actually understand why, because a lot of libertarians are only libertarians because they want to have
they're
a bubble
gay.
because they want to have a bubble to celebrate their degeneracy in and to be emboldened in it, which I don't allow them. But in terms of like, so what I would advocate for is that I don't think we need to have a giant apparatus of force to do this, because there is within libertarian literature, a lot of this done by Rothbard and Hoppe, there are ways to construct society in a way that's more comporting to the libertarian legal theory and private law and market law. There are ways to get the same outcomes in a way that don't come with the trade-offs that come when you centralize power too much via
the
state.
The problem is that absent a population which is educated enough to understand Hoppe's claim of argumentation ethics, it's unworkable.
Well, I think
here's what's
going
on in reality, mapped onto reality now for a second. Okay.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store at Lowe's.com for details.
Is that you're in a fight for power with people who ultimately they want it by any means necessary. The progressive left will take it by any means necessary. They don't care. And yes, they will kill you. They will kill you for political power. They don't care. That's what we're facing. So the question becomes, as Christians, do we let them do that? Or do we say, no, I think we're going to take power. And yeah, I think that we'll take over the state apparatuses and use them to enforce our will, which is what you're doing.
So
why is that a problem?
Well, so I don't know.
Let me get
this
follow up real quick. But my only question there is that, like, it does almost seem in the same aspect utopian to assume that we'll always be able to maintain a Christian nationalist government. And I'm not necessarily saying that's what you're saying, but I mean, that seems pretty utopian in the same way that, like, you know, Jacob.
It's utopian to think you'll be able to maintain any government long term, including the one in the United States. But the thing is Jefferson himself thought it was a utopian principle to maintain the United States, which is why he said,
if you can keep it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the thing is like, he did not expect that shit to last as long as it did. None of them did, but it did. And so if you look at Christian empires, man, they really lasted through the test of time. Byzantine Empire.
This is what I was going to say, which I don't know if you caught this part before you hopped on, Andrew, but I was saying now, I think that my critiques work best when looking at democracy and sort of the republic or like the ashes of the republic that we live in. But if we were talking about a monarchy, it's a little bit of a different story. But then it's like, okay, it seems equally hard to get us back into a Christian monarchy as it is for Kyle and I to argue for pushing us to go past liberalism and to go into, you know, libertarian anarcho-capitalism. So it's like,
Christian nationalism right now is not advocating that under the current system, as it exists as a republic form of government, where everyone has the right to vote, that these changes can occur, because they can't. You're not going to be able to bend the will of the population. Christianity has this great skill that almost no other religion except perhaps Islam has, where we're able to look 200, 300 years in the future, 100 years in the future, 60 years in the future. That's how great cathedrals were built, by understanding that these are cross-generational projects.
Right. Low time preference versus high.
What we're seeing right now is we're seeing a population collapse over time.
Yep.
And it's major. It's a major, major epidemic that nobody even knows. Nobody even knows how they're going to deal with it. They don't even want to look at it. It's terrifying to understand the extent of how bad this population collapse is. You know, there's more grandfathers than there are babies in Japan. Okay.
Right.
And
I mean, it's the same way in a lot of countries.
Yeah. And you know, Kyle.
Well, this is a global phenomenon. There's no place where this is not the case, where the population is collapsing and by the way, year over year, it's becoming hyper accelerated.
It is correct.
There's no particular reason for us to believe we won't reach South Korean numbers in the next 30 years of 0.9. Once that happens, the population has contracted so much that you're going to have to bring in tons and tons and tons of immigrants, in order to keep these populations.
Part of why open borders libertarians are retarded, because they don't.
Yeah, but
they're like.
But who are they going to get these immigrants from when the Western nations' populations are also collapsing? They're going to get them from Christian nations. Christian nations. That's where they're going to come from. They're not going to come from China. They're going to come from the Hispanic nations.
Doesn't have enough people anyways.
Yeah, they're going to come from the Hispanic nations, and they're going to come, which are heavily Catholic, and they're going to come from African nations, which are a mix between Islamic and Christian. That's where you're going to get these immigrants from. That's it. That's the only place you can draw them from. Mm-hmm. You don't really have any other, you don't have any options for to really bring in white people, because they're dying. They're dying off. Mm-hmm. There ain't enough of them. So they're going to draw in. So if this is the case, then what happens as the atheists begin dying off because they're getting married at 30, not having children? And so are domestic white Christians. As these immigrants come in, necessarily the face of power is going to change. And these people don't care nearly as much about authoritarianism as you do. And so what Christian nationalism is doing is it's prepping society for this change, which is coming. Authoritarianism is coming. The question is, do you want it to be leftist authoritarianism? Or do you want it to be right-wing Christian authoritarianism?
Well, I mean,
this is where I have crossover, and I'm insofar as the Christian nationalist project is to, sort of like build up Christian institutions and influence in the culture and society. I think that is a useful and important goal, and to be telling Christians to be, investing internally into their communities, having the biggest families they possibly can. This is all very important, I think. I am a little skeptical of being able to, perfectly predict demographic changes over the next couple centuries, although I think some of the things you're saying are
I think it's not hard, right? You need to replace mommy and you need to replace daddy.
Well, sure, but with the knowledge we have now, your projections are reasonable. But the problem with central planning is always the unknown variables that we can't see. So we don't know what sort of things might happen next year or in 5 years or in 10 years.
Well, unless people stop using contraception and having abortions, I think we can pretty much tell you exactly where it's going to go. And there's no variables which you're going to introduce that are going to be poison pills enough to vacate the idea that women are going to begin to get married younger and not use contraception. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true, though. But I mean, like, you look in the third world countries, they tend to have a higher birth rate. But it seems to be a problem with industrialization, which is interesting because
it's materialism. It's materialism. Yeah. Yes, that's
essentially
correct.
Yeah. So those countries over there don't necessarily have the same material goods we do. And then as we get more and more material goods and more move towards materialism, then we tend to have less and less kids. So I don't know how you kind of walk this line of like, hey, well, we've, raised our living standards so much, but now we don't need or have as many kids as we used to. I don't know how you fix that, and especially with all the technology. I mean, we're not going to go back. We're only going to go forward with the technologies that we already have.
You can't fix it absent giving people a reason. So materialism leads to nihilism. Mm-hmm. Secularism leads to nihilism.
Yep.
And so the thing is that these roads paved in lead to nihilism. And nihilists don't give a shit. They're on the do what you want to do, man. Right? They don't care. If the entirety, you can ask a nihilist this question. Here's the thought experiment. Assume for a second that you're on the very last generation of human beings. But they're gonna live the happiest, most comfortable lives they've ever lived in their existence, this last generation. Or you can introduce a little bit of discomfort. And they'll begin to procreate, so it won't be the last generation. Should they procreate? And they'll tell you no. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the end goal for them, ultimately, is not to have human beings in perpetually. Rather, the end goal for them is to end up with a single generation that has the most amount of decadence in the most comfortable way possible. And we just go out with a bang. Right?
Right.
Yep. You can't fix that, but you don't need to, because it's a self-correcting problem. What happens is the religious continue to breed while the nihilists fucking die off in comfort and decadence. So
assuming you're right, then I guess like the question, and this is I guess a question that won't get answered until way off in the future, but it's like, well, what do you do when you get there with that Christian majority that you've sort of won through, you know, waiting out for the secular populations to essentially select themselves out by not breeding.
You persecute progressivism. That's what you do. You persecute progressivism.
But how do you...
They've been persecuting Christians, you persecute progressives.
I'm skeptical.
You persecute their ideologies everywhere. You make sure that they're not allowed to come in institutions. You outlaw communism, which many nations have done. You outlaw socialism. You restrict speech when it comes to the domain of communism and socialism. You can do all sorts of shit, and I'm sure that they're going to.
Well, yeah.
It's going to be Revenge of the Sith, bro. Revenge of the Sith. It's coming.
I mean, so if we have a population of Christians who are all Andrew Wilsons across the board, then that might be possible.
That would be the tame version. You would want to have a population of Christians who are Andrew Wilsons. I'm the tame version of what you're going to have.
Well, so I mean, my question is that, like, I just don't see this, kind of like you said, prospering for a long period of time without...
Why wouldn't it?
It doesn't seem like an easy task, because like Jacob said, the seen and the unseen, because you know you're going to have people who gather in private and want to fuck shit up. And I mean, you could say you'll put them down, but I mean, you know, what's
but it's
the
not
deal
even just that.
Math?
It's just, yeah. I think the fundamental critique of libertarianism, and I hope that you and Dave get into this when you guys talk Friday, is just that I think that the incentive structures of centralized power, like once you're in power.
By the way, you realize he agreed to a full debate, moderated debate. So it's not just a combo, it's a debate.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for that. I think that centralized power creates perverse incentive structures, even for Christians. Like once you have this giant centralized apparatus that can control a landmass,
you mean yeah, but you don't you mean can right now? Yeah, you mean can, not must. It can create.
Well,
perverse
I don't
incentives.
Know. This is where we disagreed in our debate, and I'm not so sure. Like, can in a perfect world, maybe. But like right now, once you have that much power, then and like even in small power structures, once people get into power, they suddenly become consumed with the incentives of maintaining their power. And then
yeah, but I mean, so but here's the thing, right? Here's the thing about your dumbass libertarian utopianism is that I don't really give a shit that much about corruption, depending on scale. Like, let me give you an example of what I mean. And you guys probably don't either. Okay. Let us assume for a second that, you know, you have somebody who's in charge, like a dignitary who's in charge, right? And he really, really, really likes the wine that the state gives him. He doesn't like to share it. And so when, you know, other dignitaries come in, he pours half wine, half water because he wants to keep more bottles for himself. I don't fucking care. I don't fucking care. Is it corrupt? Yeah. Do I give a shit? Nah, not really.
Yeah, but that's not the kind of corruption you know? We see today.
Yeah,
today,
what kind of corruption like, are you? Yeah, what kind of corruption are today, you talking about?
Today, what we see is that the people go, "Ooh, I get a lot of money from weapons companies and people who make all the bombs are getting dropped on Russians and Ukrainians and Palestinians and other countries as well that aren't talked about as much in the media." And they're like, "Oh, I don't care. I'm getting all these kickbacks from these lobbyists and from these weapons companies and stuff." And that
yeah, but
me
I mean,
get re-elected.
I mean, if Ukraine and Russia are in a perpetual war of destabilization, why would we care?
Well, I mean, for one, I mean, as Christians, we should care because there are Christians living in both of those countries and humans living in both. My argument is that this is bad now. And my worry is that there are Christians, or at least nominal Christians, in government right now. So what's to say that what you're advocating for won't just end up with more of the same if you're advocating for the
same
sort of power?
So there's essentially no policy that you're ever going to be able to make ever that's not going to affect Christians in a negative way. It just doesn't matter what it is. There's no policy which can ever be drafted for the benefit of an entire people that's not going to not benefit some of the people. Everything in policy making is a trade-off. Everything.
Right. Okay. But so I agree it's a trade-off. But if we have no
So if you're looking bank, at if we have so no, if you're looking at a destabilization of these countries versus stabilization of yours, I'm taking the stabilization of mine.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, our how's that working out for us so far?
Our country is still destabilizing.
Let's see. How is it working out for us? Well, we have the world's reserve currency in the dollar. We have bases in every single nation which exists. There's zero chance of us being domestically invaded ever.
Correct.
We have the most powerful military on planet Earth.
Correct.
And on top of all of that, we have the most armed citizenry which has ever existed in the history of planet Earth.
Correct.
Don't know. It seems like it's working out pretty good.
Yeah, but I mean, once again, I don't think that's.
But we've lost the moral high ground, Andrew. Like Christians have lost their moral currency.
To who?
Engaged.
To China? Have we lost our moral high ground to Islam?
To the liberal progressives living in
No, we never lost our moral. Bro, we never lost our moral high ground. We just refused to take power because we're stupid.
It was again, at least in name, Christians.
How
dumb,
bro? How dumb do you have to be for a progressive to tell you it's very unchristian of you to take power and you go, okay, then how fucking dumb do you have to be?
Andrew, if the Christians in power were only stopping gay people from getting married and stopping people from fucking goats, you wouldn't hear much of a peep from me. The problem
we don't
is
have any Christians in power. Come on.
Okay. Well, they're nominal Christians at least. And that's what I'm saying. The problem is, this is why I said earlier, I don't think it's going to be Andrew Wilson's across the board. I don't think it's going to be necessarily even more Christian, like you're saying, you're the tame version. No, I'm not worried about people being less tame than you. I'm worried about them being less Christian than you and being Christian in name only, because just having sometimes a Christian majority can just become cultural Christianity, can become nominal Christians, right?
So they can, but I don't know of any examples of that, really.
Our own country. What do you mean you don't know any examples?
Our country.
Society.
No, our country revolves around self-ID when you're judging who is or who is not a Christian. That is not a good metric for determining these things. And so we come up with these kind of really horrific outcomes where.
What was that?
Firework, maybe? I don't know what's in the burn pile.
You want me to take the hose filter off the hose?
Yeah. I don't know what's in the burn pile, but things are exploding. Yeah, it'll be fine. Anyway. So
I like that explanation.
Yeah, I don't know what's there, but I mean, it can only blow up once. So anyway, so because it's based around self-ID, you guys come to these radically insane conclusions of believing that, oh, there's, you know, X amount of people are Christian because they say they are. Like, no, this is really basically at this point a secular nation. Your self-ID doesn't mean anything because you don't apply any metrics to determining who is and who isn't a Christian.
So this gets right into what you and I forget his name, the libertarian guy that came on at the end of our Q&A session, Do you remember his name?
I like that guy. I can't remember his name.
I can't remember his name right now.
Casimir. Casimir.
So this is exactly what you guys got into, because he was like, well, what wouldn't you say America was like more of a Christian nation before, you know,
yes.
not 19. So like,
yes, because the metrics, because metrics that they were using was looking at things like how often are you going to church? How much do you do private prayer? Things like this. And they had a different criteria than just, oh, I go to church once a month. Oh, well, or then you're a Christian.
Okay. So you don't think that things like the creation of the central bank, and you don't think the things like the creation of like the pushing of the New Deal, and then the Great Society by Lyndon Johnson, like, you don't think these things have worked to accelerate the de-Christianization of our society?
I think that Bolshevikism did that more than anything. I think that Bolsheviks did more to destroy Christianity in the nation than anything else. Now, is the central bank, is that an issue? Yeah, I mean, kind of. I really don't get on board with this mantra, the kind of libertarian bizarre mantra that is the central bank itself is some, you know, horrific apparatus. It makes a lot of sense for a nation to have a centralized bank that prints money to the nation so that you can print your own money. Congress used to do it. They would coin the money. It's not in and of itself problematic. It just depends on who's helming it.
Yeah, I mean, but for some again, reason, sounds, it seems
this,
like
this
whoever...
is utopian.
It seems
it's
like...
It's not
it,
utopian.
It just, but Andrew, I think your worldview is like, the power's fine as long as the good people get to the top. And my concern
No, not the good
if.
People.
That's
because we're going to argue. We're going to argue about who the good people are. I want the people who I agree with to be at the top.
Okay, fine. So
I don't care who secularists believe are good or bad people. I want my people in charge.
But the odds of that happening in our current system until at least, and then you got to wait 100 years, 200 years
nope.
until the population changes happen.
About 30 years when you start to experience the symptoms of population collapse, then you'll start seeing people flock to the traditional churches in mass.
You think that's a certain thing?
Yes,
genuinely
for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay. For sure. You do know why? They're projecting by 2060 that China loses half of its population.
Even sooner than that. I know some of the projections were 10, 20 years down the line. Even.
That's 650 million people. Mm-hmm. That's
their
twice the size of the United States. Yeah, that's like twice the size of the United States. 650 million people gone.
Yeah.
Once you start to see these the decrease in global infrastructure, because people don't really recognize how much it takes, how many people it takes to maintain these various things, right? So you have to maintain the fields, the crops. You have to maintain the logistics. You have to maintain all the roads. You have to maintaining the world's a hard task, man.
Okay, but I mean, the U.S. is very efficient. So like China, the problem with China is that they have a lot of internal issues and they have a lot of people, but they're very, very inefficient. So I mean, like when it comes to infrastructure, stuff like that, I'm not worried about China at all, because once again, they're very large, a very populous country, but they're just incredibly inefficient. For the West, because we have a lot of arable land, like a lot of land that we can use to farm. And, you know, we have waterways around us. We have.
Bro, why are they bringing in a million fucking illegal immigrants per year and putting them in all the produce states? Why are they doing that?
I mean, once again, we still do some agriculture, but I mean, I think a lot of those people
are not some. It's we're a global food exporter. I mean,
yes,
that's
correct.
What we do.
Yeah,
we are exporting food like nobody's business, especially produce.
Yes,
produce. We import chickens and shit. We export our arable farmland. That's what we do.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, we send billions of dollars of food over to China every year as well.
Well, all over the world. They don't want our fucking cars. They want our food.
Yes.
That's why Ford doesn't do good. That's why Chevy doesn't do good in these other markets. Why do you think in Europe nobody's driving F-150s? They don't fucking that's not what they want. They want food. They don't give a fuck about our cars. Mm-hmm. Okay? They don't care.
Yeah.
They don't care about our TVs. They don't care about any. They care about our iPhones and they care about our food. That's it. So the thing is like, ultimately, there's going to be, when you start seeing the elder population climb so high that you don't have enough people to handle the elder care. And this is a cross-generational thing now. So it's not a single generation. This happens. The next round of elderly the next year has just as few young people to take care of it as the last one. That's a fucking catastrophe, dude.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess it'll be interesting to see how the experiment plays out. I mean, what I did concede to you in our debate is that the American experiment Protestantism was not an effective bulwark against the system that the founding fathers here in America set up from it falling apart and going tyrannical. Now, if it was Eastern Orthodoxy or Catholicism that was the main church in America, would it have turned out differently? I don't know. It seems to me that Europe, where Catholicism was still a major influence, still fell to liberalism. And Russia and in Eastern Europe has dealt a whole lot of problems of communism. So I guess I still think that at the end of the day, people get into that when you have centralized power, that the incentive structure to that. And again, I think that there's biblical precedents for this. We didn't get much into the theology in our debate, but I think that when you centralize power too much, it is somewhat inevitable. Maybe it doesn't have to be inevitable, but I think because of man's fallen nature, it inevitably ends up becoming about usurping God's place in society, usurping the church's place in society, and substituting that with the state and substituting that with the goals that the state's trying to pursue.
Yeah, I know, man. Why, oh, no. Why, oh, and, no. And Tyrant King versus 800 tyrant kings. Oh, no. You know, there's 800 tyrant kings. Instead, we'd only have one tyrant king. Oh, no. Even Hoppe, who is your libertarian god, points out that under kings, it's much harder for them, even under that central power, to become corrupt because everybody knows who to hold responsible.
Sure. No, I don't disagree with you there, but I don't know that what we're going to see over the next.
But that's
years,
the ultimate centralization of power. So that defeats your entire argument. Your entire argument is. Is that if we centralize power,
kings, Andrews, there were a bunch of kings. It wasn't like one king over 330 million people over an entire continental landmass.
Oh, well, okay, but it's scalable. Like, why do you think that if the king has 200,000 subjects, he's going to somehow be less corrupt than if he had 200 million?
Well, whatever.
It's a scalable thing. I mean, you see content creators who have 300 fucking views and think they're gods. Right. So the thing is like it's all scalable to the person. But again, if your argument is that centralized power necessarily is going to corrupt you to the point where you're going to try to transcend God as a necessity, then why didn't it do that for kings?
It didn't do it for all of them. And
right. But you said all of them. You said this happens to all of them, no matter what. That's what centralized power does.
Well, eventually other, you know, smaller kings were taken over by other kings or they fell to democracy thanks to America. But
no, I mean, you have royal families that were intact for 1,000 years plus. I mean, not in England, but I mean, there's other places where the royal family, it could be cousins who take power, this and that, but they're all from the same bloodline. And no, not all of them were corrupt. In fact, a good many of them were not corrupt. They may have done what I would consider light corruption, like the wine example, or carving out additional lands they probably shouldn't have from the crown, but basically things that you wouldn't ultimately care that much about. When it came to the health of their citizenry, they were super serious about it, and they made great strides in order to deal with it. And so that's the ultimate form of centralized power, not corrupted. So it kind of destroys your argument. Plus, at the ultimate form of centralized power, you have the ultimate form of holding it responsible.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I don't know that these monarchs are quite the same type of centralized power that like we have today. Like, I don't know if they had like the ability to print unlimited currency and to touch any corner of the world at any point. The mixture of money into politics to the extent
they could
that we
point
have
at
today.
Your wife. They could point at your wife and fuck her like that. Who has that power right now? Who?
I mean, they could if they really wanted to.
Yeah, Trump, who has the power?
Trump, according to him.
Who has the power to point at your wife and be like, "Okay, she's coming home with me tonight"? Who?
The government.
No, government they don't. They technically couldn't. Not only would nobody put up with it, but on top of that, it's against the manner prescribed by law. They don't have the authority to do that. And nobody would acquiesce to the authority. And it would be unthinkable for one of them to even try. Right.
No,
but a king could do it. A king could just be like, bro, Your wife? My dick's in her mouth tonight. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. Pretty centralized, bro. Pretty centralized form of power.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you had a monarchy that was able to do that, I'd be worried about the effects of that. What else they would abuse that power for? So it's kind of like you're saying on one hand they wouldn't abuse. You're like saying on one hand they wouldn't abuse power, but on the other hand they can and could.
They could, but they don't.
Yeah, right? I mean, I guess they don't. My question there would be, you would almost think that, like, in order for somebody to establish themselves as a king in this kind of situation, that they would have to be of high moral character, because somebody probably wouldn't get that high in the ranks without being respected amongst his peers.
I mean, you have bad ones. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of examples of bad monarchs. There's just also plenty of examples of good ones. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is like, they have central authority, though. The buck really does stop with them. And they can unilaterally put people to death. They're the judge, the jury, right, the executioner, everything.
I think the main disagreement I have is on scale, because I think you think it's easily scaled up. And I think, but like, how could one family easily rule over a large landmass without having to create some sort of bureaucracy, which would then lend towards...
I mean, they did. They had massive bureaucracies, but it was still centralized. The buck stopped with them. So, I mean, if you look at feudalism, you had franklins, and you had viscounts, and you had earls, and you had dukes.
Well, yeah, but
earls that reported to dukes, and then you had franklins who reported to viscounts, and viscounts who reported to earls who reported to dukes. And yeah, it was a huge, massive administration.
At that point, we're not arguing for radically different worldviews, because like anarcho-capitalism is often like, sometimes the leftists and the goofy libertarians will be like, you're just advocating for feudalism, and it's like, yeah, it's like one step removed from that. So I mean, it's
Japanese feudalism for sure. You have classes of people, and you have a daimyo. The daimyo is basically this massive landholder, and he has a clan. This would be your covenant community, and inside of your covenant community or clan, you have your own laws, your own rules, your own regulations, this and that. And in the greater society, the way that you get along with these other covenant communities, clans, is by having peace accords, treaties, things like that. But they had their own, it was the libertarian utopia, right? They didn't even have an emperor. I mean, the Japanese wars went on for what, 600 years before the Tokugawa shogunate? They did, or longer? I don't even know. I don't even know how long. It was a long time before there was even an emperor. Before there was even an emperor. These clans all operate inside this libertarian utopia, didn't they?
Well, they didn't have, this is really like, when you don't have Christianity, any system is going to degenerate.
They did have Christianity. That was a divisive force, because they're all Buddhists. They started fighting over that too.
Well, right. Well, this is where you and I have common vision, because I think no matter what we're going to have, we need to have a Christian majority and a consensus in society. It doesn't matter what political system you have, if it's a Christian minority and Christians, or you could have a loud Christian minority that's in power even, but you need to have the prevailing cultural ethos and prevailing morality in society needs to be Christian, because otherwise it's
right. Because if you just have all of these clans all over the place who just, endlessly war with each other in a war to expand their various clans and in a war for them to expand their lands and things like this, which is kind of part of the human experience, and they have no moral guidepost, then them having just the autonomy to govern their clan or covenant community, as it were, it's moot, right? The whole point is moot. Who cares? Because there's still a bunch of uncivilized barbarian heathens who are killing each other. So ultimately, if all of them come into a central power under a single monarch who's a Christian, how's that not better?
I guess the devil's in the details in terms of how Christian the Christian monarch is.
Yeah, I mean, however Christian he is, it sounds a lot better than 700 years of perpetual brutal warfare.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always compared to what? And I never make perfect the enemy of the good. So,
I've heard that. That's a stupid rhetorical device. I heard Smith say that too, but that doesn't mean anything. Just so you know, that doesn't mean anything. Saying I don't make the perfect the enemy of the good, All that that's saying is that I'm striving towards something which is better. I'm not saying it has to be perfect. Yeah, but everybody's saying that. Who's not saying that?
Well, okay. In our world that Kyle and I come from, there's a lot of freaking people saying that, so I guess we feel the need to say it because a lot of the goofy libertarians that we're interacting with a lot, they do make perfect the enemy of the good. Like, they're not okay with anything that's not like, no, it has to be perfect, libertopia.
Well, I mean, overnight. If that's the case, then certainly what I'm offering is better. So then why not go for that?
I've said that before, that I think Christian nationalism probably couldn't be any worse than the progressive globo homo empire that we have.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Well then let's do that.
I mean, that's a lot easier said than done, but
I mean, let's do that, because I mean, it's just, it's better, and right, we don't want to make perfect the enemy of good. Sounds like it's good. Let's do that.
I can't.
Sounds good.
I mean, I'm not here to give prescriptions because I don't know what's best for everybody else. You guys seem much more knowledgeable on biblical texture and stuff like that, man. I'm the fitness and foreign policy guy, man. That's all.
No, like I said in our debate, it's like, let's make the world more Christian. Let's make the government more Christian. I just, once we get there, we do have the devil's in the details in terms of what the Christian government should do. And can do by both prescriptively and descriptively. I think in a zoomed out view, there's not much disagreement, but on some granular issues, there would be some, there might be some different prescriptions in terms of what we would want Christian government to do and not do.
Well, progressives are going to get to the point, in probably before your life is over, where you're going to start to see them advocate more and more and more. For people who have any view external to their own to be jailed, imprisoned, or outright killed. I have no doubt in my mind that that's true.
Okay. So,
because the more that the lunatic fringe, the LGBT queermos and all of them continue to move into these kind of bastions of power, which Christians refuse to take because they don't want to be mean. they institute more and more and more lunatic style policies. Okay, and well, you're already finally seeing hate speech bills come to the floor that are passing.
Okay, so, this gets to the next question then, because you see a lot of people who may be Catholic or Christian that are Zionists that are pushing for, anti-Semitism laws, and those aren't progressives. Not all of them are progressives. This isn't a progressive thing. This is Republican
government. Yeah, it is. They're all progressives, dude.
I mean, I guess you could say, but I mean, when we're talking about today's standard, where Donald Trump is considered a right winger, right? Which I wouldn't agree, colloquially that he actually is, but by today's standard,
he's not.
He is a right winger.
Yeah, he's not. He's a populist. He's a centrist populist.
Right, right. But by today's standard, he would be considered a right winger. So you
by
see
progressives,
all the people,
yeah.
Sure. All of these people today are pushing forth anti-Semitism bills, and a lot of them may be Christians. So once again, they're not real Christians.
No, they're not. So I know you guys
disagree with this. That'd be dispensationalism, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The false doctrine. But it doesn't have to be dispensationalism.
Okay.
Right. There's other motivations that come into it too. But the truth is that it's always been the case that hate speech laws and anti-Zionist laws were going to come to pass. Now, the accelerationists are helping this along as fast as they can. So accelerationists like Nick Fuentes, Jake Shields, all these different kind of characters who exist inside of the political ethos, they're trying to accelerate this process as fast as possible to get it to the finish line so people see where it ends up. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons that they go so scorched earth on Israel and on Zionism and on things like this is because it accelerates the ACLU and the response from these other organizations. And once that becomes accelerated, they start to demand this type of legislation. Now, they always were going to. It's just that these guys accelerate the process. That's what they're there to do. Like, that's their whole goal, you know what I mean, is accelerationism.
Hmm.
So that's, I mean, the thing is that what's happened is the right was the response party. They were the reactionary party. That's not the case anymore. now they've become the offensive party and leftists have become reactionaries. So, and that's what you're seeing. This is a, it's a reaction. So guy like Musk, big tech billionaire, takes the largest public square that there is and says, you can talk about whatever the fuck you want. Well, that's really bad. That's progressives really hate that. Because they can't dominate the conversation cycle, that eliminates propaganda. And it, and what happens is now propaganda is coming in from the right too. So now they're going to legislate that shit out of there. That's how that's going to work.
Yeah. No, I don't think Kyle and I would disagree with anything you said there.
So that's our next step, right? It's legislation.
Well, it's getting close to 9. I don't want to go much past 9. The conversation obviously took a unexpected turn. No one told me my man's was with Kyle. I was going to tell you to say hi to your wife. She's absolutely fantastic. And Andrew, you're very lucky to have someone as wonderful as she is by your side.
No. She's lucky to have me.
Good point.
She killed it on the Whatever podcast, man.
Yeah. She's great. She's been on the show twice and she'll definitely be on again.
I was listening to the highlights today with the one girl was just like, all these guys left me. And then she's like, well, why did this one guy leave you? It's like, oh, I wanted to hang out with these other guys, but it was okay because he was gay. I was like,
Yeah, it's always like, their biggest problem with her was we don't like hanging safe down.
But remember
that's part of the propaganda element. I mean, tone policing and telling people how a thing is said is just as important as telling them what a thing is that can be said. So it's a way to navigate conversational propaganda to create social taboos around ultimately what can even be talked about. Mm-hmm. So that is what tone policing does ultimately, is it creates social taboos. That's what it always does. Well, so I would, anyway, I'll let you guys go. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, of course.
Thanks for hopping on. I'm super looking forward to your debate with Dave on a Friday. I might try to, if I can end up being a caller at the end, I'll see if I can't sneak in there.
Yeah. Andrew, go ahead, give your plugs and, Jacob, you can give your plugs afterwards. I think we're going to, wrap here.
My name is Andrew Wilson. I'm the host of The Crucible, the fastest growing debate channel on YouTube. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end or the middle of next year, if, you know, we are allowed to stay on, which I think we will be, we didn't have the biggest one on planet Earth. So hopefully that's where we're heading. You can find me over there to give political commentary, social commentary. I'm also a blood sport debater myself. I enjoy engaging in debates of all types. And that's it. Thanks, man.
Cool. Of course. Well, we will talk soon. Tell your wife I said hello. And hey, you have yourself a good night. All right. Jacob, go ahead, give your plugs.
Yeah. At Biblical Anarchy on X is where you can find me, or look Biblical Anarchy Podcast anywhere on YouTube, social media, stuff like that. Wasn't expecting this, but hey, that was a lot of fun. So
nice.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think I said this even before Andrew came on, like if we're talking about monarchy, it's a little bit of a different equation, but I think Andrew's one of the good guys. He's not someone I consider an enemy. So I'm really excited to see his debate with Dave. Cause it'll be interesting to see how, cause Dave's, I think I can defend libertarianism pretty well, but I think Dave's going to be the, if Andrew can slay Dave, that's the final boss, then maybe I'll surrender and, I'll change my moniker to Biblical Monarchy at that point.
Biblical Christian or Biblical Nationalism. So
Well,
thank you so much everybody for listening. And until next time, take care.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.